This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
When the Apostle Peter was writing, times were troubling. Political upheaval, moral digression, philosophical and religious emptiness and confusion, government corruption, a rise in taxation and economic burdens, and on and on and on and on and on. And this growing threat of persecution, which was coalescing. Christians are now scattered all around the empire. They're misunderstood, maligned, rejected by family members, singled out by employers. Some were even beginning to experience imprisonment and abuse, even some experiencing death. In addition to all of that, all of these citizens of Rome were living under the reign of an emperor who was growing increasingly insane, even more alarming, all the more brutal and hateful of Christianity. So when the early church, under the reign of Nero, receives a letter like this, it's of course read in the assembly, and by the time you get to chapter 2, it becomes a rather startling announcement to the Christians. In fact, so much so that I think some of them would have wondered if Peter was slipping into some form of insanity as well, losing his own mind. In fact, if you'll turn to 1 Peter in chapter 2, we're going to read the opening lines in a series of new studies because Peter changes the subject at hand. And I'm simply going to call this new series Above Politics and Parliaments. Now, as verse 13 opens, which is where we pick up our study, I want you to read it, but at the same time recognize that his audience, the audience of the first century Christian, would have been absolutely stunned, shocked, disturbed to read these words. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 13. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him. Now let's just kind of stop there for quite a while. Obviously, we've got to lay a little groundwork in context here. In the minds of the early Christians, questions, having heard this, would be flying around the assembly. In fact, probably, I would guess, people would begin to mutter and talk out loud. This subject was so controversial that both Paul and Peter will elaborate on it in their letters. Now, the immediate context of verse 13 is provided in the previous verse, where the believer is to demonstrate to his culture excellent behavior, this excellent work ethic and attitude, this life of integrity that basically forms an apologetic for the slander against them and for the gospel they believe. Peter reminds them in verse 12 that they are all being scrutinized. They're all being carefully watched by their culture. Evidently, some of their good works is going to spill over into what it means to be a good citizen. Now, the larger context that every believer grapples with in every generation, including ours, is how does a believer respond to government? How does a believer interact with government? And does a believer attempt to even influence governmental institutions? Now, you ask that question today, and you're going to get a number of different responses and perspectives. I'm not going to give you all of theirs. I'm just going to give you the right one, okay? As we dive in, I'm tongue-in-cheek here. I will say this. There are those, and there are brothers that I appreciate in ministry, who would say that we ought to effectively abandon our culture and abandon politics and the government entirely, emphasizing the preaching of the gospel to the exclusion of any attempt to influence government or political institutions. And yet it's interesting to me, the older I've lived, and I've had my own views tempered over time, those same people would with me express great admiration for people like William Wilberforce. I mean, what do you do with him? I've often wondered, what would I do as a pastor if William was a member of this church, giving his life and his energy and his wealth to attempt as a member of parliament to stamp out slave trade throughout Great Britain? He was a political leader. He was driven by his Christian character and his Christian conscience. In fact, both the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter clearly emphasized the point that political leaders happen to be appointed by God. And aren't we glad when some believers are appointed? Aren't we glad when there's a Daniel of old or a Joseph with wisdom leading, involved in the upper echelon of national governmental institution? Are we glad to find somebody who acknowledges the glory of God after they've been elected? I see men doing that before they're elected. I really love it when they do it afterward. Now, while the mission of the church is clearly spiritual and our gospel message is the primary message, God happens to call men and women into spheres of influence, vocatio or vocatio, sacred calling, where they carry their biblically informed conscience, their character, their wisdom, their skill, so that they then spread their influence throughout their worlds of industry or law or medicine or agriculture or education or labor or whatever, even into the world of politics and government. Augustine, the early church theologian from the 4th century, wrote that believers who served in governmental positions were, quote, blessings bestowed upon mankind. And they really are, aren't they? Wayne Grudem, whose massive recent book, in fact, it's just huge. You could hurt somebody with it. It's a big book. I'm kind of wading through it. It's simply called Politics. Wayne has preached for me in the past, and this theologian and educator summarizes the influence Christians have had on government that we all would applaud today. Christians, he writes, were primarily responsible for outlawing infanticide. They worked hard to outlaw child abandonment and abortion in the Roman Empire by AD 374, a number of reforms had taken place. They outlawed, by AD 404, the brutal battles to the death of the gladiators, which is romanticized in our American media, but it was brutal and evil. They even outlawed the punishment of branding the faces of criminals, especially horrific. They instituted prison reforms that included segregating male and female prisoners. Can you imagine what it would have been like prior to that? They stopped the practice of human sacrifice among the Prussians and the Irish. I've got a little Irish in me. I didn't know they were sacrificing each other, but they were in the past. They argued against and eventually outlawed pedophilia. Christians were primarily serving behind the scenes that brought about the granting of property rights and other protections for women. In fact, they prohibited, if you read the biography of William Carey, you'll find that he combated this with the gospel message, ultimately the changes of the heart, but in the middle of it all, he's trying to stop this as well because it was their practice that a widow was burned alive with her deceased husband. It was considered to be the right of the widow to die. And by 1829, they found that to be finally outlawed in India. William Wilberforce gathered weekly with a group of wealthy and influential individuals in Great Britain, and they would strategically plan and pray in how to use their conscience governed by Christ, how to influence their world for the glory of God. And they certainly were successful in ending the slave trade by 1840 throughout Great Britain. What's a little lesser known is what they established. They established all these societies. They were called societies. They organized the Society for the Education of the Africans. They didn't just want them free, they wanted them educated. They organized the Society for Bettering the Conditions of the Poor. The Society for the Relief of Debtors. By the way, they saw the release of 14,000 prisoners in a 5-year span who were in prison because they were in debt, which then allowed them to get jobs so they could pay off their debt. Kind of a novel idea. But they were behind this. They also established hospitals for the poor and the blind. In fact, if you go back to the first century, the Christians would eventually establish what we would call hospitalization. And Rome only cared about the military, and they were the only ones that received any kind of medical help. They also helped war widows and veterans in need of medical and psychiatric help. And listen to this interesting statement that is brought out by another author I'm reading. He said that Wilberforce and his friends were nicknamed the Saints. We're not talking about New Orleans, by the way. They were called the Saints. They truly were. And we read that they bore this name, which was a derisive term, with gladness. I just happened to be reading the biography of Hannah Moore. I always try to keep one or two of these going. I find illustrations in them. Give them to you, whether you want them or not. But at any rate, the biography of Hannah Moore she's an interesting woman in Great Britain. And she was a close friend of Wilberforce and just found that to be coincidental, frankly, to my other reading. But she was also a friend of John Newton, whose lyrics we sang earlier, the converted slave trader and author of the more famous hymn, Amazing Grace. Hannah Moore's biography, which I'm about halfway through, it includes an anecdote unrelated to her, but because of their friendship, she included it that there was a time when Wilberforce struggled with being a Christian and being in politics. Not unlike the struggle I know many have, and the church probably doesn't help a lot in that regard. But he wrote his friend and mentor, John Newton, asking him if he should decline political involvement and just focus on his Christian commitments. And John Newton, now an aged pastor, answered Wilberforce by writing him a letter, and in the letter saying this, and I quote, "Stay at your post, do not give up your work, for you have been placed there by God." Now that's biblical advice. In fact, Paul would write, the governmental authorities have been appointed by God. Romans 13. By the way, and this is the illustration I kind of wanted to get to, Hannah Moore went against the status quo of her own generation, which viewed the education of women quite differently than we do today. In fact, it was the viewpoint of Rousseau that had won the day. Rousseau lived while Hannah Moore lived. And he didn't believe that a woman ought to be educated, but only to a certain degree, and certainly not in the same classical sciences that men were to study. In fact, he wrote, during the same time Hannah Moore started her school for women, he wrote this. This is Rousseau. You're not going to hear this in the secular education world, certainly. But he wrote that women were only to be educated in whatever related to men, how to please them, how to be useful to them, how to raise them when young, and to care for them when grown. Now, I appreciate all that. In fact, if it weren't for women, we'd all starve. Right, men? Right, men? Hey, amen. Okay, lunch is coming. I just want you to be aware of that. Now, here's what he said. This is amazing to me. He said, women should be expected to know just enough to be entertaining for an hour. So Anna Moore's ideas about educating women wasn't welcome. In fact, one medical doctor writing during the time of her school agreed with Rousseau, and he wrote with some kind of, knowledge. He wrote, now it's laughable, but he said, if women are educated in the same subjects as men, it will harm their reproductive organs. So what compelled Hannah More to violate the status quo and to seek to influence her culture? It was nothing less than the Protestant Reformation and the doctrine of the individual priesthood of the believer. In fact, she was convinced that women should be able to read the Bible for themselves, even in the original languages. And the mission of the church is not to make sure people can read Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, or whatever. It isn't to wrestle for government and their control. It isn't as a mission to identify or structure medicine or education or science or law or whatever. However, and this is the point that I think is missed, it is the mission of individuals within the church to accept their vocation, vocatio, their sacred calling from God, where God has placed them, to take into that world their Christian conscience, their Christian conviction, their Christian character, to bear upon their world of education and science and mathematics and law and government or whatever, influencing them who will never come in here to hear me. Until perhaps you win them by your testimony and influence. Frankly, I don't know of anybody in the evangelical world today who looks down on a William Wilberforce or a John Newton in his advice or a Hannah More in her passion. In fact, the unbelieving world would now look on all that they have done and say, you know, that was good. The status quo is wrong. Culture was wrong. Took somebody governed in their conscience and character by the Word of God to say that's wrong. Frankly, I believe we need a new generation of William Wilberforces and Hannah Moores and John Newtons, a fresh generation of reformers in education and finance and law. We need a Christian conscience on the School Board of Education in Wake County, by the way. Maybe one of you will run for it. Thank you. Maybe you'll run for it. We need Christians in every phase of life. I think it's interesting that Paul will commend and greet in his writing to the Philippians in chapter 4 and verse 22, those of you who are in Caesar's household. That means administration. There were believers tucked in there, asking God, no doubt, for wisdom and how to bring their Christian conscience and character to bear. We need men and women who love Christ, first and foremost, but who, like William and others, accept their post as that of God's assignment, who will love Christ enough to introduce him to that world of education or business, that classroom where you work, into every phase of life. Now that's exactly, I believe, what Peter and Paul have in mind. Now with that in mind, let's dive in and take a closer look at this exhortation. First of all, I want you to notice the command, verse 13. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Submit yourselves. Literally, place yourselves, place your attitude and your posture into that of submissiveness. Quiet submission. And it carries a sense of urgency, by the way. And I think that's because we've already learned in our study that there were slanderous accusations that Christians were seditious, they were treasonous, they wanted to overthrow the government. Well, how do you battle that? Don't plan to overthrow the government. Don't be seditious. Don't rail against the emperor. Submit yourselves, which then means it doesn't matter if you elected them or not. By the way, these people certainly didn't elect Nero. There weren't ballots back then. Doesn't matter if you agree with them or not. Doesn't matter if you like them or not. There was little to agree with or like about Nero. But Paul clearly said in his letter in Romans 13, there is no authority except from God. and those which exist are established by God. In other words, they've been placed in power by God, which means that you might not have wanted them, but God evidently did, because there they are. So imagine that rather startling statement of God's sovereignty. He really wants to take you and your perspective over and above politics and parliaments. After all the duty we perform in this free system, which we love, but after all the campaigning and all the debating and all the rhetoric and all the praying and all the talking and all the voting, God's candidate is always elected. See, that's our higher perspective. Now, at this point in Peter's letter, this would have been a great time for Peter to roll out the Christian strategy for unseating Nero. Persecution is brewing. He's obviously lost his grip on sanity. He has brought his horse to become a member of the Senate. He's married openly, both men and women. I mean, he's lost it. Now it's time to overthrow the Roman Senate for being so weak as to not stand up to him. But isn't that the way of the world? Isn't that their only hope? Isn't that their only solution? Isn't the world always working on its power moves? They live and breathe that stuff. In fact, it won't be long before Nero's throat will be cut by political opponents. Study that history and you'll soon learn that emperors normally didn't die natural deaths. So here's how the church shows herself to be unique and different. We have a posture of respect for the office. We work quietly with such excellent behavior and good works, so long as the scriptures are not violated, by the way. I don't know if I need to say that, but I'll say it. We're known for our submissive posture. In fact, it's a military term that refers to lining up in rank and file. A soldier might not like his orders. A soldier might disagree with his orders. A soldier might lose his life because of the orders, but he will obey his commanding officer. The Christian happens to have this higher perspective. He knows ultimately that God is in control, that God's purposes are being fulfilled, and we're simply called to demonstrate good works by continuing to do our best and literally helping and influencing our world that does tend to lose its grip on sanity. With our Christian conscience and conviction and wisdom and grace. Now, in case you're wondering if there are any loopholes in this command to submit, Peter's going to kind of close them all down. Notice verse 13, he stops at the very top of the food chain. Whether to a king as the one in authority. So he's just starting out at the top of the heap, okay? If you're in an African village, you would render that in your culture, you would understand it to mean chief. If you're in a communist country, you would understand that to be the chairman. If you're in a democratic culture, you would understand that to be president or prime minister. Here, for Peter's generation, this would mean the emperor. Then Peter adds in verse 14, not just to the king, but to governors as sent or appointed by him. In other words, any official representing the emperor was also one to whom we submit. And this would not make it any easier, certainly. Especially during the days of Peter. Because corruption didn't start and stop with the emperor. It infiltrated the entire empire. And keep in mind that one of the duties of the Christian was to voice disapproval kindly, respectfully. And it doesn't mean that just because they were to submit to that authority that it would violate their own conscience. In fact, it's interesting to me, if you just sort of ransack the New Testament, you have John the Baptist who spoke... openly against Herod's immoral, adulterous relationship with his sister-in-law. And by the way, how was that resolved? John literally lost his head, right? That's why. Pontius Pilate also a governor. It was to Pilate that Jesus Christ, by the way, delivered that higher perspective that Peter and Paul reinforced that I'm preaching today. Pilate said to Jesus, "Do you not realize that I have the authority to either release you or crucify you?" And Jesus calmly, graciously responded with the truth, "You have no authority over me unless it has been given to you from above." There's that higher perspective that takes you above politics and parliaments. Felix, another governor, very corrupt during the days of the apostles. In fact, Paul is under house arrest and he can't get out, frankly, because he won't pay the bribe that Felix will demand. And Felix was, his whole office was run by bribes. And we're told, just a little inclination of what might happen, but we're told this little sliver that Paul had a personal conversation with Felix. Now, we're not given any of the details, although I'd really love a chapter on their conversation. But what the text does say is that Paul talked to him, quote, about righteousness and the coming judgment. I can only imagine what that involved. And what we do know, however, is that after that conversation, the Bible says Felix was alarmed and sent Paul away. He was telling the truth. Conviction and warning in the gospel was delivered in these cases, but the overarching principle was that of respect for their office. And that remained. So the command is clear, although depending on where you're living in the world and when, it might be more distressing and difficult than we can imagine today. For us, we happen to be living in a country filled with unparalleled freedom and blessing. Submitting to authority then for us means that we're going to refuse to cut corners or wink at laws that we don't really like or run down leaders or refuse to submit to ordinances or pay that parking ticket or follow some safety code unless we get caught. I think it's rather unfortunate that the institution in our American culture that is so far behind in following the American Disabilities Act is the church. As if we don't care. I guess if they come in, we'll straighten up. I'll give you another illustration. Since we're coming up on tax season, I know that's on your mind, your heart, your prayer list and all that. You're praying about whether or not you're supposed to pay it. In their book, co-authors Levitt and Dubner explained how one little change in the U.S. tax code ended up exposing unbelievable deception, and I hate to think, I'm almost certain, but I'd hate to think that Christians were swept into this as well as non-Christians. The numbers indicate staggering enough that Christians were doing the same. But in the 1980s, according to what they wrote, one IRS research officer in Washington had the feeling that taxpayers were incorrectly claiming dependents as extra exemptions. I don't know why he had that feeling, but he had that feeling. Sometimes it was a genuine mistake. But sometimes, he complained, the claims were comically fraudulent. With one example of a dependent whose name was listed as Fluffy. Obviously a pet, not a child. At least one would hope it was a pet, not a child. Fluffy. So he decided the best way to clean up the mess was to require taxpayers to list their children's social security number. And no one agreed. No one agreed. It's kind of like the idea of showing your driver's license before you vote. I mean, just nobody will agree with that. So it sort of died, never made it out of the agency. A few years later, as Congress is clamoring for a little more tax revenue, his idea was remembered and brought up and immediately rushed for it and put into tax law for the year 1986. And when the returns came in that year, 7 million dependents had suddenly vanished from the tax rolls. Pets and phantom children had disappeared. In that year, that one idea generated $3 billion additional tax dollars. And I can only hope that it didn't represent any believer. Now, if you're wondering what the role of government is, the Bible actually isn't silent. It does include collecting taxes, unfortunately, so I joked when I said you're praying about it. You don't need to. Paul wrote in Romans chapter 13, verse 7, render tax to whom tax is due, and your taxes are due in a few weeks. In fact, on one occasion, if I could just push pause a little longer, Jesus, remember he was asked, if you know the Lord, you may have read this text where he was asked if he was going to pay his taxes. And he said yes. And then he told Peter to go get a fishing pole and or a net and go catch a fish. And when you catch that fish, Peter, open its mouth, and inside its mouth you'll find a coin that is worth enough to pay your taxes and mine. And so Peter went, and he got the fish, opened its mouth, there was the coin, and he paid his taxes. Now, to me, that's the way to pay your taxes. Go fishing, April 14th, and pray. God will perform the miracle. Well, he ain't going to perform the miracle. But he does require us to perform the principle, and that is pay your taxes. But is that all the government's supposed to do? Collect and spend taxes. Well, Peter actually gives a pretty interesting summary of the job description of a good government. Look at the same text. Look at verse 14. Or to governors, as sent by him, the king. Now notice, for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. Now just imagine for a moment, I don't want to lose you, those implications. To punish evil and praise righteousness. That sounds like moral legislation to me. How about you? By the way, the idea that morality cannot be legislated is a myth. Whether it's laws that punish murder or pedophilia or theft, they're making moral judgments. That's evil. That's wrong. Even to the point of requiring you buckle your seatbelt or drunk driving restrictions, all of it designed to protect life. Because why? Life in our moral value system has value. Which, by the way, again emphasizes the opportunity of the Christian who is entering that particular world of influence with your moral foundation derived from the clear teaching of Scripture. You then, at that post, you help your world define what is evil and what is right. What should be punished and what should be praised. To punish, interesting word, God's design for those in authority. Peter uses a word for punish, by the way, that effectively shatters the ideology that God is only interested in reforming the criminal or protecting society from the criminal, and those are wonderful things. But Peter actually uses a word that includes retribution. Here's the definition of the word in the Greek language. The inflicting of just punishment on the one who has harmed another. So the governing authority is actually commissioned by God to determine what is evil and hand out punishments and penalties for those who violate those just laws. And that isn't all. There's another word. Government is also given the responsibility to praise those who do what is right. The word he uses for praise can be translated commending or recognizing, acknowledging. Just as there are penalties for doing evil, there are rewards for doing right. In Great Britain to this day, outstanding citizens are given knighthood, a special commendation. They also do annual rewards where the Queen will give an award to those involved in their jobs, and they've just done them long enough and well enough that they surface for commendation. I remember watching one documentary A few years ago, where Queen Elizabeth was rewarding a number of people during the special ceremony, and it was very touching to watch one particular man who was a sheep herder. That's what he did his entire life. Calloused hands, wrinkled, sun-browned face. He'd weathered this incredible, difficult occupation with all of his hazards, and it sort of documented his tearful anticipation. And then that moment when he stood and bowed before his queen and she gave him an award for tending his herd, his flock, well. It's actually one of God's intentions for a good government. What a great thing that is. In the United States, we have achievement rewards or awards. We give honorary doctorates. The community at large awards this prestigious Nobel Prize in a number of sciences for those who have excelled in their fields. Has it ever occurred to you? In fact, as I study this text, it just hit me with the implications, and we're going to be finished here shortly, but has it ever occurred to you that the government is responsible not only for the security and safety of its citizens, but in fostering their moral well-being, punishing evil, praising righteousness? It's a staggering thought. Which means that all of you who are in positions of authority, you're the boss, you're the school teacher, you're the parent, you're the judge, you're the senator. And I have in this audience this morning every one of those I just rattled off. When you accept your vocation as a God-ordained appointment and you bring to that occupation your character and conviction and your Christian conscience, you are fulfilling God's role for you in that field. And let me tell you something. Our city, our community, our nation, our culture is blessed when a lot of people like you do that. Right? You know you're getting an honest deal when you deal with that guy. Culture is operational in so much more of a wonderful way when Christians do what Christians can do. But imagine what it was like in Peter's day. He's writing people that aren't living in a land of unparalleled freedom. Persecution is growing. 2/3 of the Christian community today on the planet live in repressive cultures. Why bother with submission to that kind of authority, especially, and we're seeing this in our own culture, when evil is being rewarded and commended and that which is righteous is being punished? Why bother? Why not wash your hands of it all? Well, Peter assumed you'd ask that question. And he wanted me, before I let you loose to go eat lunch, to answer it two ways. I want you to notice, first of all, in verse 15, here's the first incentive for submitting. Notice, for such is the will of whom? The will of God, not government. For such is the will of God. In other words, you are obeying the Lord's direction. And you're recognizing that ultimately God placed kings and governors in power for his purposes. And by the way, most often God doesn't explain himself. He just does it. God might be ignored by government, but this verse also implies that God will have the last word. In the meantime, he has given you and me his word on the matter. Submitting is the will of God. Number two, you're not only obeying the Lord's direction, you are silencing the Lord's opposition. Notice, for such is the will of God that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. He refers to those who are spreading slander about the Christians. We know from history the Christians were being slandered as being treasonous and seditious and planning to overthrow the government. And by the way, again, how do you silence that? You know, don't try to overthrow the government. At the same time, you're not going to burn incense to the emperor. You know he's not deity. You know he didn't descend from the gods. He's not from the sun. He's been out in it too long to think that way, but he's not from the sun. He's not divinity. So you're not going to do that. But you're going to show respect wherever you can and to the extent that you can, because he has been ordained by God. And no matter what he's doing, God's purposes are being fulfilled. And then by doing that, you are so remarkably different from the world that is always yelping. And they yelp at their own. They bite at their own. They destroy their own. You silence them. Peter actually uses the word muzzle. You muzzle them. And he, probably tongue in cheek, is implying what the word implies. You're muzzling a dog that is constantly yelping and snapping and biting. So you muzzle them. As if Peter is saying, you want to muzzle the snapping and the yelping and the biting dogs around you. Here's how you do it. With your attitude of respect. Further, he describes them here as ignorant. You muzzle the ignorance of foolish men. That doesn't mean the critics are uneducated. That's not what ignorance here means. He's not referring to their SAT scores. He's referring to willful, hostile rejection and repression of the truth. It's willful. It's hostile. They're yapping and snapping and biting, which is what makes his counsel all the more remarkable. Here, how do you silence the vicious, hostile, biting slander of people who are repressing the truth? You do not do it, implied here, by barking louder, by biting harder. Get this, you understand they intuitively know the truth. And the rumbling in their gut that causes them to be angry against that which represents the truth makes them snap and yelp and bite all the more viciously. And what they'd love to do is bring you, Christian, down to their level of demonstration. Peter is telling us here that if there's going to be any silencing, he implies it may or may not, of our critics, it isn't because you're going to be stronger and louder and bigger and better connected. No. Simply by humility and respectful well-doing and excellent behavior and good deeds and this unique attitude toward those in authority, which none of your unbelieving friends have toward their authorities. Have you noticed? They eat their own. And you're different. Even though they know you disagree, there is respect and submission to just law. And your life is marked by peace and winsomeness and grace. I'm going to end with this so you can pack your things away. I'm not going to give you the name of the county because it's these sermons get around. But it's actually in another country. This comes from a newsletter by a ministry that I'll not name. This is occurring right now. It's not going to be in your news reports, but it's occurring in the land of China. It's a remarkable thing that's happening. That'll never be acknowledged. It would never be admitted to, but it's taking place. Government officials in one particular province have become so desperate with sky-high rates of crime and drug addiction and sickness that finally, in desperation, in the mid-1990s, it's still going on today, under the radar, they turned for help to people that they noticed in this province were model citizens. And who do you think they happen to be? Christians. One official who wouldn't allow his name to be interviewed said, We had to admit that these people in this particular province were just a dead loss because of their addiction to opium. Their addiction made them weak and sick. Then they would go to one of their priests who required animal sacrifices of such extravagance that they became poor. Because they were now even more destitute, they would steal from one another and commit crimes against each other, and law and order deteriorated. It was a vicious cycle, and no amount of our government propaganda could break their pattern of living. And then he said this, we noticed that in some villages in this county, there were people who were peace-loving. And there didn't seem to be a drug problem or stealing. And their households seemed to have plenty of chickens and pigs to eat. So we, he said, commissioned a survey to find out why. And to our embarrassment, we discovered the key factor was these villages had a majority of Christians. And so we launched a daring experiment 19 years ago. We picked out the worst village in the county. It had 240 people in the village, 107 of them addicted to opium. Christians from the neighboring village agreed to be bussed in, and the government covered the expenses. You gotta love that one. And the villagers were herded together by the police. And Christians brought forward to give their testimonies of faith in Christ. They were bussed in several times. Relationships began. A year later, there were 17 new Christians in this village. And these 17 Christians soon became established financially because they stopped spending their money on opium. 8 of the 17 soon saved enough money to purchase sewing machines and start small businesses. By early 2002, just in this one village, 83 of them had become Christians, and their village began to change. This government official then concluded by saying, and I quote, "We have begun extending this strategy to other villages." Bus in the Christians. You gotta love that. And what are these officials now accusing these Christians of doing? Nothing. They've been muzzled because of these peaceful, law-abiding citizens and the gospel, which became intriguing. And then the gospel was believed, and it replaced opium with chickens. It replaced law-breaking citizens with law-abiding citizens. And that change in one life and 17 lives and families changed a village. It began to change a county. Imagine, it's going on right now. It may very well change their country. So where do we start? I mean, it doesn't sound all that dramatic, does it? In fact, it doesn't sound like it's going to do all that much. Yet this is the mind of God. For the Lord's sake, frankly, be good citizens. Respect the law and those in authority. This is the will of God. And by doing what is right, you just might silence the critics.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.